G'day, welcome back to English History Fact and Fiction, episode the 257th. Charles Starr's a runner. My name's Dick Newman, let's get on with it.
As I walk along, I wonder what went wrong with our love, although it was so strong. And as I still walk on, I think of the things we've done together.
Yeah, a little bit of Del Shannon there with Runaway to get us stuck into it.
I'm a walking in the rain, tears are falling and I feel a pain, a wishing you were here by me to end this misery. And I wonder why.
Well, wonder no more, I'll tell you all about it. Last week was about the adventures of future King Charles II. Not going terribly well for him, really. Signed the Scotty Covenant and was miserable about that, as were his supporters. He's keen to invade England, and while the Scotties like the lad, they seem to want a bit of a break from the biff. He may want to invade England, but in fact, it's Cromwell who's sitting around in Edinburgh. Charles is a big lad who's very fit. He's out and about with the troops wearing a pretty common type outfit with just a red sash to show that he's the big guy. He's mingling with the troops, being all cheerful and saying, there's never a need to worry. You've only got one life to lose.
There are more important things than living.
I'm still not convinced about that one. Okay, we've got an army, smaller than we want, but what will we do with it? He could take this mob into England or go north and pick up some Highlanders and Northern Royalists, then make a decision. Of course, there is still that matter of Cromwell being in Scotland. We all know, though, that the Scottish army is in no position to take on Cromwell. Not doable, and the idea of going to England is based on that old assumption that the people will rise for Charles. But will they? He's got a Scottish army that we all hate, and worse, religious fanatics of the type of religion we don't want. Charles really needs spies in England to tell him what's going on, but he doesn't really have those spies. I could tell him what's going on, and it's not good news, Charles. Most of the royalists have run away with lands confiscated. Others are totally cracked off that Charles signed the covenant. Others have decided just to keep their heads down and wait it all out. Who wants to go and risk their life to join a Scottish army of fanatics? Pretty much nobody is the answer. There's a very, very small group of royalists in the west hanging around plotting. They're miles away from Charles. There had been a very small uprising in Norfolk, which was brushed aside with the greatest of ease. Royalists had established a bit of a base at Inverkeithing, a bit north of Edinburgh, across the Firth of Forth, the Fife Estuary. Oh, seems pretty impregnable, with parliamentarians staying in Edinburgh. The English had a couple of goes at the place and did no good. Enter John Lambert, bit of a nobody, minor gentry, family nearly went bankrupt, but John turned out to be good at the biff and got into Parliament, so he's a commander. Off he goes to capture the port of Burnt Island, and Cromwell can ship in troops. 4,000 of them, with the Scotties having just a bit over that number at Inverkeithing. Here we go, with about 800 Scotties off to heaven and 1,000 captured. The English lost 8 men. That was the end of Scottish plans to retake Edinburgh. Charles will be saying, we need to strike back and invade England, but the Scotties aren't convinced. Their army will just hang out at Stirling, giving Cromwell the initiative for the next move. That was a bad idea then. The new Duke of Hamilton, brother of the executed Duke of Hamilton, will finally say, invading England is a shit idea, but all the other ideas are even worse, so let's go. Hamilton was the leader of the non-Covenanter Royalist faction, so Top General Argyll, leader of the Covenanter faction, will sulk and go home. Still, off we go with morale low because of the infighting. At least the English nobles are united. No, of course they're not. And of course Charles, like his dad and granddad, has his very own George Villiers, Duke of Buckingham, to say giving command of the army to a Scottie is not on. I should lead it. Don't be a dick, says Charles. Even if an Englishman commanded the army, I have top generals with me, so it wouldn't be you, George. George Villiers can now sulk and refuse to talk to Charles. Nor will he attend the council. He'll even protest by not changing his clothes. That's not much of a protest, is it? So, yeah, he can become a bit more smelly. English propaganda is out nicely. We're publishing a list of every Scotty invasion since 1071. A long list of failures and barbaric Scotty action. They are evil invaders, and it's un-English for those English who have joined them. In they come then, with some cheering and waving for Charles, with other towns keeping their gates shut and taking inside the welcome mat. Cheering and waving might be happening here and there, but there's no heart man coming out to join the team. Scotties, though, are finding guys saying, yeah, this is far enough, and then they'll slip back to Scotland. Numbers are falling without any biff even happening. Oh, here comes some biff. Well, sort of. Parliamentarians are just giving them pricks up the rear. Keep them unsettled. Then we go to Lancashire, and the Catholics will surely rise for Charles. No, he's at the head of a Presbyterian army. Here comes the brave Earl of Derby in from the Isle of Man with his supporters just to run straight into a parliamentary army. 1,500 royalists against 3,000 parliamentarians. A wounded Derby with just 30 guys will end up joining Charles. 64 had been killed, 400 captured, and the rest went home. Well, sounds nice. Went home, but it was tried to go home while being hunted down and killed by parliamentarians. As an aside, this was devastating to the population of the Isle of Man. 170 guys had been conscripted, never to be seen again, and that was a pretty big percentage of the Isle of Man population. Can it be worse for Charles? What do you reckon? He's got parliamentary spies in his army. Parliamentarians knew to expect the Earl of Derby, and Parliament has received information leading to the arrest of a couple of thousand royalists in England. Big names among these, Duke of Richmond and Lord Beauchamp, who both would have been big-name leaders in the royalist forces. In goes Charles to Shrewsbury, who have the gate closed. Parliamentary commander will say, fuck off, we hate Scotties. The English propaganda's done the trick. Royalists just aren't turning out. Sir Tom Middleton was supposed to raise the Welsh, but he won't even receive letters from Charles. They're intercepted. The Duke of Hamilton is talking up despair, saying, we have to give the biff somewhere or it's over. Okay, let's go to Worcester with a big bunch of exhausted men. Right at the start of the Civil War 9 years ago, Worcester had been the first to declare for Team Royal. They will open the gates to Charles. Charles will do some speechifying to the locals, which shows he is totally out of touch with what is going on in England. He's saying religion will all be settled with us doing the covenant stuff. Fuck, nobody but the Scotty Covenanters want that. He will offer to pay the arrears of any parliamentary soldier who wants to swap teams. They don't want to leave team winner for team loser, Charles. Okay, which of you brave boys wants to sign up for my army? What? Nobody? Yeah, nobody. Charles can go up the tower of the cathedral to watch the parliamentary cannons smash away at the town walls. Below him are the dead wicked King John and the equally dead Prince Arthur, son of Henry VII. A dead Ted III might have been more handy, but no, he's not there. He's in Westminster. Charles will see a spot where the parliamentary forces look a bit weak, so he's off leading an attack. 3rd of September 1651, Battle of Worcester, or the Last Battle. 16,000 tired, hungry Scotties with morale in the dunny versus 28,000 of the new model army of well-fed and feeling invincible hard men, led by their invincible leader Cromwell, and they're nicely set up, the town is surrounded. However will this go? Well, it'll give us nice paintings of Oliver Cromwell on his white horsey, and nice paintings of Charles running away, if that helps in the hit department. Let me point out, though, that the Scotties will fight well. They haven't got any choice. They're too far from Scotland to do a runner. Back to that first attack led by Charles and Hamilton. 3 hours of fierce action, and there goes the Duke of Hamilton. Glorious death. Just what you want. All we need is more Scotties to hop in, and this could win the day. So perhaps we might think that Charles should have stayed behind so he could order more troops in. But no, he wanted to get stuck in personally. He is a Stuart after all. Thought I'd chuck that in to see if it'll gee up the troops. But the rest of the troops already think that they will get done, so they're not going to rush in anywhere. Cromwell certainly will reinforce his guys. Royalists will have to make a fighting retreat back to the town. Parliament will capture a redoubt that has the Royalist cannon. Those cannons can now be turned on the Scotties and Royalists. Royalists are in a panic, but Charles will keep his cool. Certainly a braver prince never lived, having in the day of the fight hazarded his person much more than any officer of his army, riding from regiment to regiment. Yeah, I don't know if that makes him the bravest prince that's ever lived. 700 of the 28,000 parliamentarians won't be going home. 3,000 Scotties likewise won't be going home with 10,000 captured. Cromwell said this last battle was the toughest he'd ever fought. The Royalists have been pushed all the way back to the town. Charles will dump his armour and get a fresh horsey to run away while the Earl of Cleveland leads a brave cavalry charge to buy time for Charles. So Charles, along with about 3,000 guys, managed to do a runner. Most of these will be hunted down. Earl of Derby was captured. Court-martial, head off. The Royalist cause is in ruins. Charles is on the run in England with the most wanted posters everywhere. It's the low point of his life. Oh, boo-hoo-hoo, my dear listener. Would you like a minute to compose yourself, grab a hanky, blow your nose? You right now? Okay. Later in his life, Charles will bore the socks off people with the "Did I ever tell you about my escape from Worcester?" Yes, Charles, about a million fucking times. The ashamed sun had blushed in his setting and plunged his affrighted head into the depths of the luckless Severn, and the knight, ready to stain and spot her guilty sables with loyal blood, was attiring herself for the tragedy. Oh, fuck, give us a break, mate. But I suppose we'd better see what all the fuss was about. There goes our brave prince with just a few retainers out the back door. George Villiers, of course, the not-yet-dead Earl of Derby, and one of the Scotty Big Dicks. It's a mad dash, so it won't be long before they're lost. They took a trooper with them who was supposed to know the area. All he can say is, "Oh, yeah, we're north of Worcester." Derby will say, "Okay, well, if we're north of Worcester, there should be Brewood Forest a bit further. Good place to hide out. And then we could try for Boscobel House. They kindly hid me there when I last ran away from a parliamentary army. Totally loyal to you, those mob at Boscobel House." Those people were Catholics who you'd think are no friends to the king, but Parliament has been belting them up a bit, even worse than Jim and Charles had. Recusancy fines are up, priests are banged up in slammers or killed, and Catholics generally are guilty of being royalists unless they can prove otherwise. A complete reversal of the innocent until proven guilty rule. Catholics generally, though, are more interested in preserving their religion than getting involved in a civil war that involves Protestants against Protestants. No joy going down that path. Still, they have an underground network operating and are useful at hiding humans like priests. Charles is about to discover this, and more importantly, discover that they're actually totally loyal to him. Turns out Charles has copped a break. Charles Gifford, the owner of Boscobel, is actually right here, right now with Charles. He will say, "Look, Boscobel is not really a good option right now, but White Lady's, the former priory, is a safe house for us, and it's even closer. Great, we have a plan, so off we go. Sneak through Kidderminster, then Stourbridge, speaking French as they go." No idea why they thought speaking French would be a good idea, given the Pom's hatred of foreigners, but it worked. In they go to White Lady's at dawn. Just a ruin now. It's nicely isolated and our royals have not been to bed in 36 hours. Somebody remembered to bring bread and cheese. Well done, that man. Charles will ditch his kingly clothes and dress as a woodsman, and his beautiful hair will be cut off. The next stage of the plan involves a splitting into smaller groups. There's too many guys to be inconspicuous, and really there's not enough to be able to defend. Charles will tell one guy where he will be going. The others don't want to know in case they're captured, and captured they will be, except for George Villiers, who will make it to France. I shall reveal to you, my dear listener, where Charles is intending to go. London. The last place Parliament would expect him to go. Sounds like a plan. Sun's up, so Charles is off out the back door to hide in the forest. His only companion is a guy, Penderel, who'll look for a safer place but will fail. He will, oddly enough, bump into a guy who is the secret chaplain of the secret Catholic gentleman. Do you reckon your master would hide the king? Yeah, that chaplain will say, can't see why not. Charles, meantime, is hungry and thirsty. He's close enough to the road to see soldiers who certainly look like they're out there hunting. Nice bit of heavy rain and the soldiers will be off. While he's there, he can think of all the people along the way to London who will help him, and he's coming up with nothing. So London is ditched and it will be the Welsh ports instead. Supporters are in Wales. London is full of parliamentarians. Charles might be disguised as a woodsman, but he's still very tall. Off he goes with his companion with one fright where a miller will spot them yelling, "Rogues, rogues!" Yeah, it turned out that miller was actually worried because he was harbouring royalists. Fortunately, it's been rather chaotic, so the most wanted posters didn't go up for 6 days. We didn't know what had happened to Charles, who may have been among the dead or hiding in Worcester. £1,000 reward will now be out. Average worker wouldn't earn that in his lifetime. Even so, around 60 different people will help the lad out. Look out for a tall black man over 2 yards high is the warning. It will be a night in the barn, then we need to cross the Severn River. Tricky, soldiers are guarding the bridges. They've been smart enough to guard the boats too. He will head back to Boscobel and have to cross a river to get there. Charles was a good swimmer and will have to help Penderel, who can't swim. In they go to get some happy news that a couple of other big-dick royals are hiding out nearby, safe for now. In comes one now, Major Carlos. He's got a house nearby, but that is sure to be searched. Boscobel is still a risky proposition, so the Prince and the Major will climb a big old oak tree nearby and set up camp in the canopy during the day. Parliamentary soldiers are so close, our guys can't hear what they're saying. Evening, and they can go back to the house. That oak tree is known as the Royal Oak, which then gives its name to plenty of pubs, such as the Royal Oak in Townsville, where I spent many hours when I was young. Charles, being a bit out of touch with reality, will ask for mutton for dinner. Now, Penderel hadn't been able to afford meat for months, and he knew going out to buy a big old bit of sheep meat would attract attention. He'll slip next door and nick a lamb for dinner. Nice dinner, then off to the priest's bolt hole for a sleep. It's built for short priests, not tall kings, so that won't be very comfortable. Sunday, we're up and about with no sign of soldiers, and Charles can spend some nice time in the garden. Sadly, he's got to get a move on. The soldiers are sure to search that house. He'll be off to Mosley Old Hall, whinging all the way about what a shit horsey they lent him. Oh, great king, says Pendrell, can you blame the poor old Neddy who has to carry the weight of 3 kingdoms on his back? Oh, that's nice. My troubles make me forget myself. I thank you all. He can say goodbye to Pendrell, but at Mosley he will find another one of his mates. That guy will say, fantastic disguise, Charlie. I hardly recognised you. Big fat liar, he's 6'2". Charles can go off to the priest's bolt hole. Nicer than the last one. It usually houses Father John Huddleston, who'd fought for the Royalist Army during the war. Huddleston is a prime example of a Catholic Englishman who is totally loyal to the king. He's patriotic, and that'll be a nice lesson for Charles. Charles will even get a tour of the top-secret chapel with the crucifix and candlesticks and all the popey stuff. Charles will say, if God makes me a king again, then you Catholics will have full freedom to do whatever you like in the magical department. And Charles will even read some of the Catholic stuff. But the net is closing on. Boscobel has been searched. Major Carlos, who spent time in the Royal Oak with Charles, had got away and will be the first in to see Charles's sister Mary in the Lowlands to let her know that Charles had escaped. Parliament will go from Boscobel to White Ladies. Oh shit, they're on his trail, aren't they? The guy there will have to put up with being slapped around a bit, but will only confirm cavaliers had visited, but he had no idea of their names. In they come to Mosley. Oh dear! They have caught up. Charles is in the priest hole. Owner of the house will cough a lot and say, nobody here, and I certainly haven't been involved in any soldiering. My cough is too bad. Off to Bentley Hall, home of Colonel Lane. It's getting trickier and trickier with the manhunt going on. Colonel Lane's daughter is due to go and see her sister at Abbotsley. Fantastic! That's just west of Bristol, and very close to a water Uber. Charles will change out of his woodsman's outfit into a servant's outfit. Trouble is, he's got no idea how to act as a servant. He can't even think to take his hat off when Jane comes out. He'll use the wrong hand to help her onto a horsey. Fortunately, Jane is intelligent. Yes, that's what we need. We need a woman in there. And she's got a nice, firm character. Her horsey will lose a shoe, and it'll be up to Charles to go and get that fixed. He's being a servant. Off he goes to the smithy. Here's Charles. As I was holding my horse's foot, I asked the smith what news. He told me there was no news he knew of, since good news of the beating of the rogues of the Scots. I asked him whether there was none of the English taken that joined with the Scots. He answered he did not hear if that rogue, Charles Stuart, was taken, but some of the others, he said, were taken. I told him that if that rogue were taken, Charles Stuart, he deserved to be hanged more than the rest for bringing in the Scots. Upon which he said, I spoke like an honest man, so we parted. Yeah, that was all right. Back on the road, and we'll run into some guys on horse. Charles will say, let's just go full steam ahead, break through. But Jane's brother-in-law, who's with them, will say, no way. England is currently a fair bit lawless, Charles, and I've already been beaten up once this month, so let's detour. Another message for Charles. Travel's not safe for anyone, really. Time for dinner, and it's up to servant Charles to roast some meat. What we use is a thing called a roasting jack. At this time, if we're at home and rich enough to have one of these things, it's like a spit that rotates using a treadmill. You get a dear sweet puppy to walk on the treadmill to rotate the meat. Whatever the travelling version was, Charles had little idea how to set it up. He'd seen it done at Pendrell's and eventually got it going. Somebody, not in their party but around the place, will make a comment. Oh, says Charles, I'm just a poor tenant's son. There's no need for one of these at our house because we can't afford meat. Oh, well done. Close to Abbotsley now, but we have to go through Bristol. Okay, that's done. That was easy. So we get to Jane's sister's house and won't be telling her who Charles is. The cover story is that Charles the servant had taken ill on the road and we need to keep him with us, but keep a bit clear of him. Charles will be put in the buttery and overhears someone in the house give a rather accurate description of him. Well, not totally accurate. Charles is said to be 6'5", 3 inches taller than the rather tall sick servant. Worse, the butler of the house who'd been in Charles I's household will whisper to Jane that he thinks the ill servant might actually be the missing prince. Has Charles been rumbled? No worries. The butler will go to Charles and say, look, you have been rumbled, but by me, and I'm totally loyal. Can I take an oath to you? That butler can go out and look for a water Uber, but there's none around. Going to Wales by now is out of the question, with it being the place that would definitely be manned by parliamentary forces. Better to head south, where we have the Western Association of Royalists. They haven't been any use so far, but now they could be. New plan then, head to Trent Manor in Somerset. Jane Lane is still needed to provide the cover story for Charles. Trouble is, her sister just gave birth to a stillborn. That's sad, and it's a bad time for Jane to just nick off. Charles will come up with a solution. It'll be a forged letter from Jane's dad saying he's so sick, so she should come home. Terrible timing, though. Parliament are issuing fresh instructions for the hunt for Charles. They've decided he would likely go to Jersey, so the normally sleepy ports he was about to go to will now become full of soldiers. Not that Charles knows this, of course. He can't just Google the news. Good news, though, is Somerset is a great place to get lost, and Trent Manor is well off the beaten track. The manor, though, is also next to a church, and that's not good. Bells will start ringing, and Charles will say, send someone to see what the fuss is about. Oh, happy day, they are saying in the congregation. Charles Stuart is dead. Yeah, sadly, that's a false alarm. Well, not sadly for Charles, I guess. Point is, soldiers are still looking for him. Charles is back in a priest hole, but needs to keep moving. Where to? Lyme looks like a good spot. Small town, but not too small, with plenty of shipping. It's now known as Lyme Regis. That's a gift from Charles. Off goes one of Charles's guys with a yarn that he has a party of gentlemen looking to cross the channel to avoid creditors. A deal will be done with a Captain Ellerston, who will organise a guy Limbury to get a ship to a nearby fishing village. The date and time are set. A room will be booked at the Charmouth Inn for Charles and a couple of guys to hang out a bit, just to help a runaway bride and groom, is the story. Goodbye, and thanks to Jane Lane, and you, my dirty little listener, wish to know whether or not Jane Lane showed Charles her girlish charms. Hang in there, all shall be revealed in the fullness of time. But for now, farewell, Jane. Another woman will ride double with Charles as part of that runaway bride and groom story. Off go the lads to the beach, ready to spot the ship, which will not turn up. Oh dear. What happened to Limbury? His missus thought he was up to no good. Nothing to do with Charles, just that he was up to no good, so she locked him in his room. For our royals, it will be moved to Bridport. Lots of soldiers there, so this will be the greatest danger. Some guy will say to Charles, have I met you somewhere? Don't think so, says Charles. Who do you work for? In the chat, the guy will reveal he worked near a Mr. Potter, who had entertained the royals previously. Oh, sure, says Charles, you must have seen me there. I was his servant for nearly a year. Charles will decide he needs to go back to Trent Manor. Meanwhile, he's been rumbled, again. An amazing bit of luck, though. The guy who's worked it out was so very devout, he will want to go and have a good long chat with the baby Jesus before alerting anyone, and Charles is gone. Soldiers will head off in the wrong direction.
Oh yeah, I'm
so Charles is still running with the good news that the soldiers are heading the wrong way, and the bad news are that he and his mates are lost again. They'll find a village called Broad Windsor and get a room. Just after they get there, in come 40 soldiers on their way to Jersey. He's back in the utmost danger, but they have women with them, and more incredible luck. One of these women will proceed to go into labour. Thank you, sweetheart. A baby is born and the entire village is out wanting to make sure the baby isn't abandoned there. If the baby gets abandoned, then they have to bring a bloody thing up. The best thing the soldiers can do is get out, taking the baby with them, and everything goes quiet again. Our lads can move back to Trent Manor for 2 weeks, trying to come up with a plan. It's back to looking for a water Uber. Not going that well with so many soldiers around. It will need to be head off to Sussex. Hill House is the first destination owned by Mrs. Amphilus Hyde, widow, cousin of Big Dick Edward Hyde. Mrs. Hyde will let everybody know her girlish charms are absolutely available for royal inspection. He'll be more interested in the view of Stonehenge. 5 more days in a priest hole, and this is going to turn into claustrophobia for Charles. He'll suffer from it. Off to Brightfelmstone. Moan to us as Brighton. Yeah, Brighton's easier, isn't it? Ship has been organised to include a party of illegal duelists this time, looking to run away. Here is Captain Tattershall, who can see straight through the disguise. As soon as they're alone, he'll kneel and kiss Charles's hand. 15th of October, 1651, 4 a.m. After 6 weeks on the run, we are finally off. 2 hours later, and soldiers will be looking around the port and boats for the king. Off we go to the Isle of Wight to drop off some coal. Bit tricky, because all the sailors know they've got Charles on board. But it'll be all right. Next day, we can see the coast of France. It's into a small boat to be rowed ashore. Now, all those people who had helped Charles will eventually be rewarded. The ship named the Surprise will be renamed the Royal Escape. Jane Lane will score a watch and a jewel worth £1,000 plus about £1,000 a year pension. But that's in the future. But as the name Jane Lane has come up again, we shall move into erotic territory. Word will get out that Charles had escaped and Parliament have her name. Her house will be searched, but she'd smartly done a runner. Or really, she did a walker. She walked all the way to Yarmouth, disguised as a country wench. Now there's that wench word again that gets gentlemen excited. Well, me, I get a bit excited about it. Onto a water Uber, over to Charles, who will greet her most affectionately, and the gossip magazines definitely have the rumpy pumpy going on. Charles's sister Mary will call her the king's wife. Charles will get her a job as one of Mary's ladies, but there'll be regular affectionate correspondence. She'll get her own novel, The King's Mistress by Gillian Bagwell. I haven't read it, but yeah, it's out there. Historians have her as not good-looking, but who cares? She's marvellous. Yeah, who cares? She's great, I think. But I did have a look at her portrait just to check for myself, and I've got no idea why they said she wasn't good-looking. Probably just propaganda. On the same day Charles had boarded the ship, Darby had his head off. If they'd nabbed Charles, there's very little doubt that his head would have been off too. Bringing Scotties into England, yeah, it's a very bad look. Charles is in France, but he is dirty, scruffy and overly thin. Nobody thinks he's a king. His old tutor will come in and say to Charles, "Can you take me to see the king?" Henry German will come in with a clean shirt at least. Charles has been wearing the same shirt that Father Huddleston gave him weeks ago. Oh, stinky. But after all that adrenaline, Charles will now be on a downer. People want to know the story, but he's got to keep quiet. There's too many people in England who supported him, and they won't want their names mentioned. And civil wars back in France. I suppose it makes a change from the wars between the surly waiters and the English tourists. Charles can also give the chat to Anne-Marie Louise, that super wealthy heiress. She had thought Charles a bit pathetic last time he was in France, and he certainly didn't know how to chat up a chick. But this is older Charles, and he's got that chat going nicely. Mazarin will work out not to allow this to develop and frequently start talks with Anne-Marie about marriage with Louis XIV. Prince James will be allowed to go out and play in the Civil War. Tricky, with Louis still being a kiddie, both sides are claiming they're fighting for the king. Yeah. James will have to say he's just going on behalf of himself, nothing to do with Charles or England. Louis XIV will turn 13, which is the right age for him to take over in France. Bad news for Charles is that James is having a marvellous time doing the warrior stuff. He's a natural soldier. Charles is hanging out in Paris being totally broke. He and Mum Queen Mary are struggling to buy food, and there's the Louis Condé fan club outside yelling at them because James is fighting on the other team. Charles will say it was the most miserable year of his life. Charles will unhappily find himself involved in the Civil War. Duke of Lorraine, who you may recall has a mercenary hire business, had been offered cash by the Spanish to fight against the royals. He wanted Charles to broker a deal with Louis XIV, and Charles will succeed, with the Duke of Lorraine going to Team Royal. Those talks occurred outside Paris, so Charles came back to Paris only to find Condé in charge. Oh, awkward. Condé will boot Charles out of Paris, so he's got to go to Saint-Germain. There he sits, watching royalist forces take Paris back. Worse, our super wealthy heiress will be up for some fun, so she will go full on Amazonian warrior and fight for Condé, actually saving Condé's life at one stage. Good for you, girl. Of course, the royalists will win, and the wealthy heiress is in disgrace. Louis XIV will never, ever forgive her. Back in Paris, and the war is over, so will the Frenchies help Charles now? No, just long and involved talks. Charles is rapidly turning into a nobody. England has declared war on the duchies, and he's not in it. Charles will make offers to the duchies, but they're not fond of royals, and particularly Stuarts, what were they putting up with his auntie Elizabeth and his sister Mary. Mary's man, William II of Orange, can score his early death again, just 24. Baby William is heir to the Orange gig, and through his mum, he is in the succession for England too. Terribly important baby. As usual, it'll be a blue over who controls the baby. Mum Mary and Granny Amalia are non-compromised types. A tripartite deal will be made to present a united front to the duchies, but many nasty things have been said by Mary and Amalia against each other, and it's all damaging stuff for the House of Stuart. For the duchies then, what's Charles got to offer? A few ships is about it, and they're currently privateering in the West Indies under the control of Rupert. Duchies are also Calvinists, so it's like trying to do a deal with the Covenanters, and stories are going around that Charles is filling out the Pope for cash. Hyde, who is acting Secretary of State, will also point out that for the Stuarts, we don't know whether it would be better for England to win in this war or the Dutch, so let's not get involved. This will get worse when, eventually, Cromwell and the duchy start peace talks. Cromwell wants part of the deal to be that the House of Orange gets the boot out of any sort of succession or royalty at all. That will be fine and dandy with the duchy, so Mary will be joining Auntie Elizabeth as someone with nothing, who will just whinge loudly about it all. And let's not forget our Scotties. Following their big defeat at Worcester, English forces occupied Scotland and have forced them into signing a deal to join the two countries. Way to stir up the national pride in the Scotties, and sure enough, the Highlanders will rebel. Putting that down, pretty easy for Cromwell. The Scotties will also argue about whether they should just run the show themselves or let Charles run it from Paris. That'll open up feuds. Charles will want another Scottie army to get going and will decide to go back to Scotland. But he won't actually go. Mazarin won't let him. Charles's guys in Scotland will make attempts to raise an army, but it won't go anywhere. And Cromwell can be declared Lord Protector again, taking us back to a type of monarchy, but it still weakens Charles once more. From what we can make out, Charles will now suffer from depression. Mazarin and Cromwell are looking to do a treaty deal. Suddenly it'll be a good idea to get rid of Charles out of France. Mazarin, who'd been refusing Charles permission to leave France, will offer to pay his full pension if he agrees to piss off within 10 days. He's free at last, but no grand parade out for Charles. He, with his guys and a cart for their baggage, will just wander off with no cheering or waving. For his courtiers, this is yet another low point, but for Charles, he's on the free-at-last path to happiness. And he even gets to leave Mum behind. Bonus there. Trouble is, where to? A spa for a start, for a nice bit of relaxing. The duchies won't have him, so it'll be the Spanish or Empire territory around the lowlands. Charles has a new good buddy, Theobald, Lord Taff, an Irish guy who had fought with Ormond in Ireland. Theobald had also tasted the girlish delights of Lucy Water, and it seems her second kitty was his. He's been doing negotiation-type work, and is a handy Catholic who can talk to the other Catholic big dicks. So he's turned into a close friend. Sister Mary will come in for a visit and a nice catch-up. She's a young widow, so romantic rumours can grow. Gossip has it that the eccentric Queen Christina may join them, and she's also on the marriage market. Just as well that gossip is wrong. Christina is mooning over Oliver Cromwell. Oh, dear. Reports back to Cromwell from his spies have it as a happy group of royals with dancing and the having of the fun. Off to Cologne, which was chosen because it's managed to be neutral. He'll get a nice welcome, good accommodation, good food and bits of entertainment. Oh, please stay, say the locals, and Charles will say, great, sure. His courtiers, though, are wondering, when might their pay arrive? There's no sign of it, but they've got a roof over their head and they're getting a feed, so the merriment will continue. Charles will still manage to buy some clothes, a sword, and lots of shoes. He seems to have a bit of an obsession with shoes, this lad. Charles is still a royal, and it works then as it does now. If Queen Betty or Wills and Kate or some Prince of Monaco turned up in Australia, then it's our shout. We pay for everything. Back with Charles, instead of paying everything, which is a big chore, the idea is that the royals get a pension to cover their costs, and that's another reason Charles picked Empire territory. But we've had a continuous story of these pensions not getting paid, and it's happening again. Cologne was great when Charles got there, but it's turning out to be just a rather nice cage. Courtiers are still fighting and Charles is still broke. He'll learn a couple of languages and do lots of walking. He doesn't have a coach, poor love. Back in England, a half a dozen English big dick royalists have been pining for the good old days when there was a king to hand out cash and prizes. They've joined together to form the Sealed Knot. Should have got marketing in for a better name than that. Charles has signed off on the organisation and has provided a bit of hope for an uprising. Hyde is a bit excited. His opinion, which seems pretty sound, is that Charles will only get back as king if it happens within England. Any of this turning up with foreign hard men is bound to fail. Well done, Hyde. Charles gets it, so has sanctioned the Sealed Knot to coordinate one big uprising in England. Oh, hopeful boy. Obviously, the Sealed Knot is an organisation of half-dozen big dicks, so obviously they will squabble amongst themselves. It's what we humans do. But you know, it's worse. Will other people take direction from a half a dozen squabbling big dicks, even though they have the Charles tick-off? No way. John Gerard with some guys is to assassinate Cromwell because Gerard hasn't read history, and then he'll declare Charles to be king. Cromwell has spies and will set a trap for our lads to fall neatly into. One will go on transportation to Barbados, which is the new thing for criminals, export the buggers. Two will be hanged, and one will get a merciful beheading. Then we'll get a thing called the Ship Tavern Plot, which has no details. The organisers gave it away once they saw those executions. A splinter group will form. Charles can see they won't do any good on their own. The main group won't have anything to do with them. But they're determined to go ahead anyway. January 1655, and the splinter group will come in asking him to order the Sealed Knot to join them. He'll reluctantly write to the Sealed Knot saying, "Hey guys, this mob have no hope unless you join them." Lots of our courtiers from Europe will sneak back into England to negotiate between the two groups, but really, nobody had Charles's total authority or clear instructions. He's indecisive and stalling, but at least the splinter group are held in check. March 1655, and the splinter group want their uprising. Lucky guys will be in Leicestershire and Staffordshire, where it's a total fizzer. Bugger all's going to happen in the north, with big dick conspirators having to run away, and most of us can now see that Parliament has everything under control, so the whole uprising is abandoned. Except the guys in the west who didn't get the memo. They could have just read a newspaper. Cromwell was on to this back in February, knocking over their transportation of weapons, and a number of arrests had been made before they even made a start to the rebellion. Back to the west, and the Royalists had gathered outside Shrewsbury with a view to taking it. It was a soft target with a small garrison. Shrewsbury's governor, though, was not soft, and he just scattered the Royalists before they even got started. The big surprise was at Salisbury, where Parliament had broken the thing before it started with arrests, but some Royalists rallied. In they went, getting guys out of the slammer and giving them weapons. Parliament will come in, though, and it'll be all over again. One big dick escaped, a few executions will take place, and hundreds of prominent smellies will be off to the West Indies. A handy reminder that the indigenous West Indians are extinct by now, thanks to the Spanish. And perhaps you might want to know that while that was going on, we have a handy record of one of those dear, sweet, kind and loving followers of St. Dominic. Yes, a dreaded black friar who let us know that he had seen this and that those indigenous West Indians were the rarest of humans. Peace, love and lentil type who just didn't know what hit him. But the story is a bit stranger than that. This Dominican was the 16th century version of a humanitarian and tried his hardest to fight against their extinction. Sadly, his answer to the question of who'll do the work then was that the Spanish should implore black humans from Africa to take the place of the indigenous West Indians as slaves. Still, 10 out of 10 for his views in the context of when and where he was, but I'm off track. Parliament was never in any danger at all. Cromwell's efficient spy network and infighting among the royals doomed the thing to failure, but we should still have some propaganda. The propaganda was that the rebels were the filthy levellers, those guys who want more people included in voting rights. Nobody likes that. Charles will do some covert sneaking around to get a good spot to sail to England. Parliamentary spies are just behind him. All sorts of good news, though, we'll get through to him. Fairfax, still leader of the army, has defected to Charles with all the troops. It'll be the one saying Charles is in Yorkshire and the entire north has risen for him that will allow him to see it is all just bullshit. Off he goes back to Cologne, dejected once again. But we're going back to Paris a few years earlier to catch up on Queen Mary and Henry Jermyn. Henry was firmly on Team Queen and they agreed on whatever was said to Charles. Hyde just opposed anything they said, and his position was helped by Queen Mary, who was becoming a very annoying mum. It was his disagreeing with everything and anything that made Charles realise that this was more about Hyde's personal feud with Henry Jermyn, so he kept an open mind. Jermyn, though, wanted to sink in the boot, so he and Rupert came up with an accusation of treason against Hyde. That Hyde was writing to chief villain Oliver Cromwell. He had irrefutable evidence. Yeah, I don't know. Charles and Hyde will soon sort that out and Jermyn's credibility is gone. Worse, Mazarin had decided that English royals needed to be booted out of France. Our top negotiator with Mazarin was German, and we know that he'll fail to have that order rescinded. German's now looking like a dud. There was only Mary and German left in Paris. And then Queen Mary will convert Prince Henry to the Catholic magic show. Oh, dear, look, that's a really bad look. Hyde will make a big deal saying that Henry German had tried to cover the conversion up. Charles will write to him saying, you need to prove your innocence, Henry, or never see me again. Tough call to prove your innocence, Charles. That's why we don't have that shit. Henry and Mary had a big blue over this. It was a very bad idea and very damaging to the restoration of Charles. Mary said restoration wasn't going to happen anyway. Saving Henry's soul was more important. Henry German will point out, yeah, sure, it might be more important, but it's going to cost you your relationship with Charles, and Queen Mary will tell him to piss off. They'll kiss and make up, and Prince Henry will write to Charles to say Henry German had tried his hardest to stop the thing. Charles will write an all-good mate letter to Henry German. Henry German, though, was right about Charles's relationship with Queen Mary and will work to get them back together, and that will get him zero thank-you notes for his efforts. He wasn't helped by Mary's rather sharp letters to Charles. 1654, and Queen Mary has cobbled enough cash together to buy a mansion, which she'll turn into a convent for the poor nuns of the Visitation of Mary, keeping a suite for herself. Lovely place for a retreat. They've also moved out of the Louvre and into the Palais Royal. It's not much fun there, but it's frequently used by government, particularly to receive embassies from England. We keep on bumping into parliamentarians so we can scowl at each other. But more good news. Queen Anne will give Queen Mary a rather lovely mansion for her and Henry to move into. Noted for its painted ceiling in the dining room, depicting Bacchus, the god of wine and fun times, and Venus, the goddess of love and good times. Mary and Henry can live there quite happily, like a middle-aged married couple. Shall we leave Mary and Henry in a gorgeous chateau in France with Bacchus and Venus? I think that would be very kind of us. But how about Auntie Elizabeth? Oh, God, her. She's created a literary society, the Union for Joy. Just what we all need, but it's only for the elite, not people like me. There is an initiation rite for gentlemen, and I hate that fucking shit, let me tell you, I hate that. It's crap. A gentleman must be able to laugh, dance, make merry, and I kid you not, demonstrate they can hop like a sparrow. See, I would have failed that. We've got a new pensionary in the Dutch States. A what, you say? A pensionary. Think of it like this. The stadtholder is a bit like a king, being the head of the state, while the pensionary is a bit like a prime minister. That can't go well, as we've seen in England. But so far it's worked for them. The new guy is Johan de Witt, from whom we will learn something in the fullness of time, but I can tell you Johan won't like that one little bit. But right now, he's just been appointed to fill the vacuum left by the untimely death of the stadtholder William of Orange. Three regents for baby William won't be effective. Because guys like De Witt are the power players, they'll be in Elizabeth's circles, despite being Republicans. England can declare war in 1652, and a lot of the English courtiers will be off to Germany, including Charles and James. Both Elizabeth and Amalia, baby William's granny, will be on the outer. Rupert and Maurice are both away doing the privateering. They're having good times in the West Indies with a bit of a fleet by now. In comes a hurricane, and the only surviving ship will be Rupert's. Maurice has gone to a watery grave. Elizabeth will be in denial, being certain that he was washed up somewhere. Well, for some reason, she picked Algiers. How the fuck would he get from the West Indies to Algiers? Oh, well, for some reason. I don't know. And she'll spend lots of time trying to find him, or sending guys out to try and find him. She's not going to fucking Algiers herself. Treaty of Westphalia, and Elizabeth is certain she will finally be getting at least Frankenthal back. It was part of a jointure and has been released by the treaty. Once again, though, her dear lad Charles Louis will step in and say, no way, that there is mine now. But at least she can move out of the lowlands and go to Heidelberg Castle, also held by Charles Louis. Jane Lane will go with her. Elizabeth will inform the duchy government that she wants to leave. Just a small problem. She owes the locals £93,500. So if the duchy government could find a solution to that problem, then we'll all be happy. They'd already promised her £6,000 to pay for the fucking removalists. They'll suggest that she pawn her jewellery and silverware, and they'll loan her £12,500, plus give her £15,000, but would then stop the pension payments to her kiddies. Get that Charles Louis to pay the rest, they reckon. Charles Louis will say no, ungrateful little shit. It's worse for Elizabeth when she reads the treaty. There's lots more that the Emperor had given her, but it didn't get past Charles Louis. And that included a nice big pile of cash. She'll demand the cash. Charles Louis will say no. Duchies will ask the English Parliament to stump up the cash. Parliament will say no. Elizabeth will write to Baron Craven. Usual stuff. There's not even bread on the table and it's dark at night because I can't afford to buy a candle. Of course, that letter will get out, so the Duchies will approve an annual pension of £1,200 so she can't write that shit anymore. Elizabeth will strike back at Charles Louis, saying she refuses to come to him in Germany. But he might have taken that as good news. Really, though, the last straw for Elizabeth was that Charles Louis wouldn't let her call herself Queen in Germany. Elizabeth has stopped writing around the place with political bits and pieces, but nobody now, if ever, is listening to her. And here comes a dose of shingles for her. She's also drinking wormwood wine, which has certain effects. It will get your bowels moving and get some nice, satisfying farts out of you. She'll keep writing to Charles Louis to see if she can get some money out of him. By now she knows the answer, though, so she's trying to get him to have certain jewellery got out of hock. Her dear precious wedding ring is one. Another is a necklace that Robert Dudley gave to the Gloriana. 1,048 diamonds in the thing, called the knotted chain. Charles Louis has zero interest. Her creditors are looking to see if they can sue the English Parliament to get some debts paid. Things are grim again, or still. Finally, in 1656, Charles Louis will send some cash just to shut her up. To be fair, it was Elizabeth's money that he was sending. Well, I think we might just turn our attention to England and the glory of the Republic. We left it with Oliver Cromwell being made Lord Protector. The bare-bones Parliament has been yet another dud. Cromwell was very disappointed. It had been his idea, but it failed. He decided it was a message from God who wanted Oliver to have the power. But he's tired and a bit disillusioned. Big ideas aren't dropping into his head. The army has been purged of radicals, but the level is pretty much gone. Well, they're not really gone. They're still hanging around, but they're gone out of the army. The generals are pretty much all landed gentry, and they will be his council along with a couple of minor nobles. Other soldier types and nobles will also be advisers. This is the government for now. They'll repeal some of the stuff done by the previous parliament. Cromwell sees the priority now as uniting the nation. Even his enemy Hyde can see that Cromwell is a good operator. Cromwell proceeds with strange dexterity towards the reconciling all sorts of persons and chooses those out of all parties whose abilities are most eminent. London has been stabilised and the city will treat Oliver to a banquet to say, thanks, mate. Off he goes with no cheering and waving. Books written about him, praising him, aren't selling. His opinion polls are sadly down. Fair enough, people were expecting the revolution to bring improvements, but it's the usual case of same shit, different flies. The radicals have rightly given up on him. Numbers of these guys are now talking to royalists. Cromwell gave nothing. A king in exile might promise something in exchange for help to be restored. While the common smellies and radicals are off, Cromwell and others are still firmly on board. He saved the landholders from the filthy diggers with their communistic ideas, and again from the levellers who wanted more people to vote instead of just them. Lawyers have been saved from dopey ideas like being fair and doing pro bono work. Churchy types have been saved from the idea of cancelling tithes, and the merchant class are happy that no big changes have hit them. It remains conservative England, where, yeah, pretty much no change. And there's plenty of people who never want change, so, yeah, it's not everybody that doesn't like him. Purges in the Army and Navy will continue, more radicals out. Also out is freedom of the press. Newspaper articles have to go to the censor first. Banned are opposition pamphlets. Oliver Cromwell hasn't got the memo that bans don't work, so opposition pamphlets will continue to be printed. But there goes freedom of speech. The thinking is that in order to be a nation of free people, then we need to limit those freedoms. There you go, my dear listener. Weasel Words and George Orwell would be very proud. And just a little bit of Anushka Shankar there to get us into some historical fiction. And this week I really enjoyed a book, The Mogul by Thomas Hoover. This is a fictional account of our man William Hawkins, who got about one sentence in the East India Company episode. He's the guy that sailed to India and he got to the court of the Mogul, spent quite a bit of time there trying to get a trade deal sorted and failed ultimately. He failed. So this is a fictional account. And some people, I believe, would not like this because it's one of those English guy finds a different culture, thinks, fuck, this is a lot better than our culture, and goes native, as they say. Of course, this did happen to plenty of Englishmen. In fact, the government ended up passing legislation banning English from marrying locals in India because so many were doing it and turning native. And I guess the thing is, like, the English think that they're the fucking best people on the planet Earth, and if you turn your back on their culture, then you're insulting their culture. So they don't want to have anything more to do with you. The other point is that if you turn into an Indian, then whose interests are you looking for? You're looking for the East India Company's interests, or you're looking for India's interests? So I thought it was a great read, though. It takes you through a lot of the culture and different religions and all sorts of stuff, while still being a bit of a ripping yarn. It's a very long book. It'll keep you nicely amused for quite a while. The Mogul by Thomas Hoover. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. How about we pop over to France with the Limitless and El Beach. Hope to see you next week. Bye.
Okay. Un soleil a tombé par terre, brûlant comme à la moricière. À la surface de l'horizon, je contemple la situation. Je vois le ciel incandescent, le blanc du sable étincelant. Je vois passer le troisième âge, les obèses et les enfants sages.